Jamie Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Stick with it, because you deserve the significant raise you need and other benefits. Let's get back who we lost, okay? Yeah. We saved them. It's about time them to step up for us. Yeah. Thank you.
President Biden makes history by becoming the first sitting president to stand with striking workers on a picket line. We'll get the latest on the auto workers' strike as Donald Trump heads to Detroit today to a non-union auto parts shop. But first, to U.S.-Mexico border, where an increasing number of migrants seeking refuge are crossing into the United States.
The city of El Paso only has so many resources, and we have come to what we look at a breaking point right now.
We'll speak to the head of the Border Network for Human Rights in El Paso and Chicago Democratic Congressmember Chuy Garcia, who was born in Mexico.
America is nothing without immigrants, plain and simple. It is who we are as a nation, and it's about damn time that we live up to our values and give immigrants the respect and the dignity they deserve.
Plus, we'll look at the U.S. government's landmark lawsuit against Amazon and the growing Democratic calls for New Jersey Senator Bob Menendez to resign after he was indicted for bribery. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Biden became the first sitting U.S. president to join a picket line Tuesday as he expressed support for auto workers in Wayne, Michigan, in their strike against the Big Three, Ford, GM, and Stellantis.
The fact of the matter is that you guys, the UAW, you saved the automobile industry back in 2008 and before.
You made a lot of sacrifices. You gave up a lot. And the companies were in trouble. But now they're doing incredibly well. And guess what? You should be doing incredibly well, too. It's a simple proposition. Just about being fair. And folks, stick with it, because you deserve the significant raise you need and other benefits.
President Biden was standing next to UAW President Sean Fain. Donald Trump is speaking to auto workers today at a non-union auto plant near Detroit. He'll be skipping tonight's second Republican debate. Meanwhile, General Motors started hiring $14-an-hour scabs to cross the picket line. In more labor news, television and movie writers are back at work after ending their historic 148-day strike at midnight following an exceptional tentative deal and a new contract with Hollywood studios and streaming services. The Writers Guild of America said Tuesday three of its internal boards had unanimously voted to end the strike and send the tentative three-year agreement to its 11,500 members for ratification. The new contract includes an increase in residual payments, higher compensation, better benefits, protections against artificial intelligence, and gains on data transparency and staffing minimums. The U.S. Supreme Court rejected Alabama's bid to use a Republican gerrymandered congressional map that includes only one majority black district. It's the second such ruling in just 3 months after the Supreme Court in June ruled the map violated the Voting Rights Act and ordered Alabama to include another majority black district in the seven-district state. Over one quarter of Alabama's population is black. A special master was appointed in the case and proposed three new congressional maps that abide by the Supreme Court order. A three-judge panel will select one of the maps. In New York, a judge ruled Tuesday that Donald Trump, his sons Donald Jr. and Eric, and the Trump Organization repeatedly violated state law when they fraudulently inflated the value of their assets by billions of dollars to obtain loans and lower their insurance rates. The ruling came as part of a civil lawsuit brought by New York Attorney General Letitia James and will force some of Trump's business licenses to be dissolved. Trump could lose control of a number of his properties properties, including the Trump Tower, his New York City residence. It's a major win for Attorney General James, whose case against Trump is scheduled to go to trial Monday and will focus on alleged falsification of business and financial documents, insurance fraud and conspiracy. James is seeking $250 million in damages and a ban on Trump doing business in New York. Federal Communications Commission Chair Jessica Rosenworcel said Tuesday she plans to restore landmark net neutrality regulations that were repealed under former President Trump. This comes after Democrats this week took majority control of the five-member FCC. They'll vote on reinstating net neutrality next month, which would bar internet providers from blocking access or throttling customers' connections based on how much they pay or which websites they visit. This is Rosenworcel speaking at the National Press Club yesterday.
Broadband is no longer just nice to have. It's need to have for everyone everywhere. It's not a luxury. It's a necessity. It is essential infrastructure for modern life.
Digital rights activists welcomed the announcement. The watchdog group Common Cause said, quote, to allow a handful of monopoly-aspiring gatekeepers to control access to the internet is a direct threat to our democracy, unquote. The Federal Trade Commission and 17 states have filed a sweeping antitrust lawsuit against Amazon. The plaintiffs say Amazon illegally uses, quote, punitive and coercive tactics to unlawfully maintain its monopolies, unquote, allowing it to charge higher prices, harming customers and weakening competition. Among other things, the complaint accuses Amazon of burying retailers' discounted products so far down in search results that consumers are less likely to find them. The lawsuit could lead to a forced restructuring of Amazon. The Senate announced a bipartisan stopgap deal that would keep the U.S. government open through November 17th, as well as provide $6 billion for Ukraine and $6 billion in disaster funding. Senate leaders hope to pass the measure by the end of the week, but it's not clear whether it can break past the ongoing gridlock in the Republican-controlled House, where far-right Congress members have already threatened to remove Speaker Kevin McCarthy if he brings the bill to a vote. McCarthy's planning to re-propose separate legislation that includes 8% cuts in social spending and resumption of construction on Trump's U.S.-Mexico border wall. Hunter Biden suing Rudy Giuliani and Giuliani's former attorney, Robert Costello, for the total annihilation, he said, of his digital privacy when they hacked, then distributed data from a hard drive associated with his personal laptop in 2020. Giuliani and Costello have repeatedly acknowledged accessing the hard drive's data. The information was used in a story by the New York Post implicating President Biden's alleged corrupt business dealings, which have since become the focus of the Republican-led House impeachment inquiry against Biden. In Iraq, at least 100 people were killed when a massive fire ripped through a wedding party in the northern Nineveh province Tuesday night. At least 100 others were injured. The blaze may have been caused by fireworks used inside during the ceremony. Relatives of the wedding guests have been desperately searching for their loved ones.
My nephew's wife, Rawan, and their children, Sharbel and Gazelle. All three of them, we can't find them. We were looking in hospitals across Mosul and couldn't find them. We're looking in all hospitals, nothing. They said in Erbil, we called there and they can't find them either.
The death toll from an explosion at fuel depot in the Nagorno-Karabakh region of Azerbaijan has risen to 68 as tens of thousands of ethnic Armenians have been rushing to the border following a military blitz by Azerbaijani forces last week. Samantha Power, head of USAID, said the U.S. would provide $11.5 million in aid for the worsening crisis and urge Azerbaijan to facilitate access to those in need by humanitarian workers. Armenia is warned of an ethnic cleansing campaign in the contested region. Canadian lawmaker Anthony Rota resigned as Speaker of the House of Commons Tuesday, days after he led a standing ovation in the Canadian Parliament for a Canadian-Ukrainian veteran who fought in a Nazi SS unit during World War II. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky joined in on applauding 98-year-old Yaroslav Hunka. This is Anthony Rota speaking Tuesday.
I reiterate my profound regret for my error in recognizing an individual in the House during the joint address to Parliament of President Zelensky. That public recognition has caused pain to individuals and communities, including the Jewish community in Canada and around the world, in addition to survivors of Nazi atrocities in Poland, among other nations. I accept full responsibility for my actions.
Meanwhile, Poland's education minister said he's taking steps to investigate whether Hunka was involved in crimes against Poles during World War II and to possibly extradite him to stand trial in Poland. Officials in Ukraine say they're clarifying information over whether top Russian commander Viktor Sokolov was in fact killed after Moscow released footage of him in which he appears alive and well. Kyiv reported on Monday its forces killed Sokolov, the commander of Russia's Black Sea Fleet, and 33 other officers in Crimea last week. Israel's tourism minister, Chaim Katz, is in Saudi Arabia for a UN conference, marking the first public visit by a senior Israeli official to Riyadh as the two countries move towards normalizing diplomatic ties in a U.S.-brokered effort. This comes as the first Saudi ambassador to Palestine made a trip to the Israeli-occupied West Bank, the first time a Saudi delegation visits the region since 1967. Nayef al-Sudairi met with Palestinian officials, including Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas in Ramallah.
Good evening, Your Excellency. I am proud and happy to be in my country, Palestine, with East Jerusalem as its capital, God willing. Hopefully, next time or next times, we will go together to Jerusalem.
Saudi Arabia said it will only normalize relations with Israel if there's progress in the creation of a Palestinian state. And J.P. Morgan Chase has agreed to a $75 million settlement with the U.S. Virgin Islands in a lawsuit over the bank's role in financing Jeffrey Epstein's sex and human trafficking empire. Epstein owned two private islands in the Virgin Islands. J.P. Morgan did not accept any liability in the settlement, which will be split between legal fees and funding efforts to combat human trafficking. The suit, filed last December by former U.S. Virgin Islands Attorney General Denise George, also accused J.P. Morgan of profiting from Epstein's operations and failing to report suspicious activity. George was fired soon after she launched the lawsuit. She'd recently secured a $105 million settlement from Epstein's estate. This comes after J.P. Morgan Chase in June agreed to pay $290 million to settle another lawsuit brought by Epstein's survivors, who said the bank ignored warnings about Epstein's abuses for years because he was bringing in wealthy clients. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Coming up, we go to the U.S.-Mexico border, where an increasing number of migrants seeking refuge are crossing into the United States. Stay with us. Estoy aquí. I am no longer here by El Lado Negro. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Mimi Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
We begin today's show with an update on the sharp increase in the number of people attempting to cross the U.S.-Mexico border in recent weeks as thousands seek protection from violence, conflict, extreme poverty, and the impacts of the climate crisis. This week, Mexico's government announced it would accept the Biden administration's demand to start deporting migrants from northern Mexican border cities back to their home countries. The move came after shelters in the Texas border city of El Paso said their overcapacity is thousands of asylum seekers continue to arrive. This is El Paso Mayor Oscar Leeser.
The city of El Paso only has so many resources, and we have come to what we look at a breaking point right now.
Meanwhile, Meanwhile, immigration rights advocates have denounced the Biden administration for deploying more military personnel to the southern border and for not prioritizing humanitarian relief or addressing the massive backlogs greatly delaying the processing of asylum and immigration cases. A recent report by Syracuse University found a backlog of some 2.6 million cases in U.S. immigration courts. Last week, the Biden administration announced it's granting work permits and temporary protection from deportation to nearly 500,000 Venezuelans. Migrants from Venezuela who are already in the U.S. as of July 31st can apply for temporary protected status. The relief will last a year and a half. These are some of the voices of Venezuelan migrants who've recently arrived at the U.S.-Mexico border.
Queremos pasar por un mejor futuro.
We want to cross into the United States for a better future. The journey has been very difficult. We have been mistreated. We have been hungry. We have suffered. The children are tired, but we are going with the glory of God. We will cross the border so that we can do well, because our country is struggling.
Harsh U.S. economic sanctions on Venezuela have largely contributed to worsening living conditions in the country, forcing tens of thousands of Venezuelans to flee.
We took on this risk and this journey to escape the crisis in Venezuela. We prefer to die on our journey to the United States than to die of hunger in Venezuela.
Meanwhile, thousands of migrants continue to arrive in cities like New York. About 100,000 people have arrived in Chicago on buses from the Texas-Mexico border. For more, we're joined by two guests in El Paso. Fernando Garcia is the founder and executive director of the El Paso, Texas-based Border Network for Human Rights. And in Washington, D.C., Democratic Congressmember Chuy Garcia of Illinois joins us, longtime immigration advocate who himself migrated from Mexico, the first Mexican immigrant from the Midwest elected to Congress. He's visited a center in Chicago where some migrants have been received and in May sent a letter to Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas calling for expedited and additional funding to help the new arrivals. Last month, he spoke out after a three-year-old migrant child died while she was being bused from Texas to Chicago. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Congressmember Garcia, let's begin, Garcia, let's begin with you. If you can start off by talking overall about what's happening right now. I mean, I think across the political spectrum, it's clear the immigration policy in the United States is broken. What you feel needs to be done?
Well, the historic interventions, military interventions, the sanctions that we've imposed on different countries in Central America, in the Caribbean, in South America, and of course the failed war on drugs are all important factors that are displacing people, creating misery, and responsible for much of the violence, corruption, and impunity in Central America, increasingly in places like South America, like Venezuela. That is at the root of what is driving people to desperation. And they're coming home, they're coming to the U.S. seeking asylum and refuge, fleeing terrible consequences, risking their lives to get here. And we continue to have an immigration system that, of course, is broken. We haven't had immigration reform, a bill passed in 36 years. And obviously, we need to change our immigration system, and we need a system that responds both compassionately and that responds to the root causes of why people come to this country. Unless we do that, we're going to continue to react this way. At the same time, it's clear that we need to act multilaterally in cooperation with countries that are descending countries where we have a long legacy of, again, intervention and sanctions. And these are the things that are driving people to this country.
Congressman Garcia, I wanted to ask you about the different narratives that we're hearing about the migration crisis. Chicago clearly has received more than 14,000 migrants in the past year. But what we don't hear about is that Chicago has also received, as of June 30th, more than 29,000 Ukrainians, twice as many as the number of migrants from the border who have come here. And yet we do not see any Ukrainians in police stations. We don't see any cries that the Ukrainian refugees are overrunning the Chicago area. Instead, they're being quietly integrated into the general society, getting work permits immediately, being able to access government assistance. What about this different narrative that's created of those coming from the southern border versus those coming from Europe?
It's an excellent point that you make, Juan. We welcome folks from Ukraine. We welcome folks from Afghanistan, from other places in Europe and other parts of the world. But it seems that because of our actions across many decades in this hemisphere, whether it's Haiti, Cuba, Venezuela, Central America, and all of the interventions that we were behind, even though we know very well why people are being displaced and are coming to the border, we refuse to have a system that treats asylum seekers more equitably, that welcomes them, and that helps to integrate them. Look at how much hell raising we had to do to get the administration, the Biden administration, to respond last week by designating Venezuelans eligible for temporary protective status. This wasn't the case with the Ukrainian wave of migrants that Chicago and other cities welcomed to this country. So obviously, there is a difference in how we treat people, and it's a part of the tragedy of a broken immigration system that doesn't establish norms and practices that are equitable for everyone seeking asylum and refuge in our country.
And how do you feel that the newly elected mayor of Chicago, Brandon Johnson, is handling the crisis? Because clearly there are many in some communities, there's resistance, local communities, to the establishment of shelters or temporary housing in particular neighborhoods of the city.
I think the mayor of Chicago, Mayor Johnson, is living up to Chicago's commitment to continue to be a welcoming city and to welcome everyone who comes there. The resources that are necessary to successfully provide food and shelter for people have created a strain on the city's finances, in part because the federal government isn't providing sufficient funding for those purposes. The state of Illinois has also stepped up along with the city and is helping to care for these migrants. Obviously, the federal government needs to put up more, and the city needs to look at all of the options to make the integration of and the welcoming of all these immigrants as humane as possible. We continue to look for those types of resources and solutions, and my hope is that we will do the right thing by treating people. But obviously, the surge and the busing by Republican governors of people to welcoming cities like Chicago and New York is causing a strain, and it is pitting people against each other. While Chicago seeks to become a more equitable city, the increase of migrants at this time is causing fissures with other communities and even a debate within the immigrant community about what we've done in the past and what we're doing now. That's part of the reason we called for work permits for Venezuelans and recent arrivals, but as well for those that have been here for 10, 20, even 30 years and remain hopeful for the ability to work and obviously for a pathway to legalization and to citizenship in the future. What's causing this is our broken immigration system and Congress's failure to address immigration reform.
We're speaking to Congressmember Chuy Garcia of Chicago in the Capitol Rotunda in Washington, D.C., where, well, it's possible government will shut down in a few days. We'll talk about that in a minute. But we're going to turn to another Mr. Garcia right now, Fernando Garcia, longtime executive director of the Border Network for Human Rights, with us from El Paso, where your mayor, Oscar Leeser, has said that El Paso is at a breaking point. Explain the situation there. Also, the pressure the Biden administration has brought on Mexico to deport people to their home countries, and what El Paso looks like right now.
Yes, of course, Amy, Juan, and Senator, good morning. Listen, we are very frustrated here at the border, not only the organizations that we work with, but also our communities, because what it seems to be happening is that there's been the recycling of crisis after crisis of the same institutional responses. And when I say that is because since last year, 2 years ago, we were demanding major changes to the infrastructure at the border, to invest more in welcoming centers, to invest more in welcoming infrastructure, to provide enough services, shelters, healthcare, education, water, food for migrant families that were coming across. And nothing has been done, not by this administration, obviously, and much less from the previous administration. So we are seeing the same situations over and over. In December, the same situation. There was an increased number of people coming. And then the response was either tough enforcement, deportation, or the acceptance of some of them that end up being sleeping on the cold weather in El Paso in the streets. The same situation happened in May also, where we had no capacity. The community organizations and religious organizations that actually provide some of these sheltering, obviously, they don't have the capacity, the resources, and the money. But again, no major federal funding coming to build more infrastructure. And that is exactly the same situation. In Juarez, we have obviously thousands of people in refugee camps. But in El Paso, in downtown Plaza, what is called the Plaza de los Lagartos, we had dozens, and not enough, it's not hundreds of people have been processed already. They've been processed. And they've been released in downtown, and they don't have the means and ways to get to their destination up north because they don't stay in El Paso necessarily. But they don't have, again, essential services. They don't have water. They don't have food. They don't have any shelter. So, but this is the thing. I mean, the thing is, this is not new. We have seen it many times already, and we've been denouncing it even here in your newscast. We've been telling one after the other that we need to reform a system that had been failed, and nothing has happened. But the opposite had happened instead, which this expansion of harsh enforcement policing against migrants. And now, as you mentioned, Mexico agreed with the United States to start deporting people from Juarez directly, from those camp in refugee camps. People is going to be subject to harsh deportation and detention. So the expansion of the U.S. enforcement-only strategy is now permeating into Mexico, which is not new. Mexico is embracing also a very harsh stand against immigrants coming through Mexico. So the situation for immigrants overall is getting more difficult. We have a major failure of the administration to provide some remedies short-term, but also long-term. And I think it seems that there is no way to resolve it because nobody has the willingness to actually do something else that is not only political demand political actions that are politically motivated.
And Fernando, I wanted to ask you because all along the border, especially in Texas and all those counties along the border, the majority of the population is of Latinos. And there, as the border gets militarized, more and more Latinos get hired into the detention industry that's occurring there. What is the impact of the failure of the federal government to handle the crisis in terms of the how Latinos along the border are reacting to the immigration crisis?
Well, I think you have different reactions, and depending on where you are at the border. But I think most of the border communities, El Paso, Del Rio, Eagle Pass, Laredo, McAllen, Brownsville, most of them are welcoming communities. What that means is that they come up and open their wallets, they have opened their homes, their churches, to actually provide some kind of safety and safe environment for migrant families. I think there's nothing you can say about those communities because they are the ones providing enough resources, the limited resources, but enough to actually get support for these families. But this is important. What you mentioned is because the lack of a fundamental, sensible strategy in Texas has actually allowed, and I'm saying this is very important, allow the state of Texas and Governor Greg Abbott in Texas to launch its own racist enforcement and strategies at the border. So he has used this human rights humanitarian crisis in launch a political game, which essentially is using immigrants as part of the political platform. And he launched the Operation Lone Star, which is operation. This operation is deploying Texas National Guards and state troopers at the border, building border walls, river buoys, all of these things to make the statement that the border is wide open, which is not, but it's causing a lot of harm in our community. So we don't have not only in Texas,